You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love Revolution Radio, we take a look at the Indigenous and Allied resistance to the North Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as explore why the metaphor of war doesn't work for making nonviolent change, and reflect on the meaning of being human in this rapidly changing world.
People the world over recognize that we need to protect our water, that it's crucial, that we are connected to it, we are related to it in very real ways, and we understand that our life is dependent upon the health and the preservation of those waterways. Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Nidaps Nidabesks Aguanu. Welcome and greetings to you from my homeland. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in Penobscot territory, in and along the shorelines of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry, and greetings to all of our listeners wherever you are in the country and across the world. Thanks for tuning in this week and joining us for this conversation. It's going to be an interesting time. I feel that shift in the seasons out here in Taos, New Mexico. The corn is growing on my little short corn stalks out here that were sent to me by our first guest on Love and Revolution Radio, Sandy Lyon from northern Wisconsin. And it's Flint corn, I believe. It's always a beautiful thing. You just watch these seasons turning and changing, and you also kind of mark and watch both yourself changing and your culture and your society. As we know, sometimes we watch those changes and they aren't so nice to watch, and sometimes we see some pretty inspiring stuff. And one thing that's been on my mind this week, Sherry, is the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance and how I'm seeing both at once. We're seeing the worst of this continued aggression of the fossil fuel industry in a time when they need to be going off to the sidelines, but also the best in terms of how people are coming together to stand up for water and the earth and our continued existence on this planet.
Yeah, and I think the important distinction there is that those who are standing up are protectors, not protesters. And that's one of the things that they've really been trying to communicate to people is their role as protectors of life, because we all need water to live. And the waterways that they're protecting serve a quite vast area. And the complete lack of responsibility of the oil and gas companies that want to bury their pipeline under the Missouri River is just astounding. It's unimaginable that they're so careless, so neglectful, and so arrogant to think that they can do this without any consequence when every single one of those lines has had problems. And we know that the history of this particular industry and this particular product has been abysmal, that nearly every one of the pipes has leaked at some point in time to some degree. And when you think about all of the families, not just Native but non-Native alike, that rely on that water source to live, and the absolute madness that drives these companies to put those lives at risk, it's inhumane and it's criminal, really, in my mind.
I was just reflecting on how many huge environmental disasters, and we say environmental disasters, but it's more accurate to say the poisoning of the water that we need or the land that we need to survive and the other creatures on this earth do as well. Thinking about the BP oil spill in the Gulf, thinking about the river contamination in West Virginia and the other one in Tennessee, and when the river in the Navajo Nation, which is still toxically contaminated right now was poisoned. We don't have an infinite amount of rivers on this planet. We don't have an infinite amount of water sources. They don't just magically fix themselves. Once you contaminate a land, a river, it's contaminated. It's like checking off your own sources of survival. It's absolutely insane. And like you said, Sherry, we should know by now the dangers of not just the oil and gas industry, but industry in general, which has had a reckless attitude towards their responsibility towards the rest of the planet for not just the last couple decades, but for hundreds of years. I like the distinction as well of that protectors, because every time I hear that, it makes me really consider the work that I'm doing as an activist, as an organizer, and how I frame for myself what is the work that I'm doing. Am I protesting? Am I acting in opposition to a problem? Am I saying no, no, no? Or am I really grounding myself and rooting myself in the practice of saying, this is what I love, this is what I care for, and this is what I will do to stand up to make sure that it has a place on this planet?
Well, I think that we need to be mindful of the fact that ensuring that the natural world is able to exist unmolested ensures that we have a place on the planet. Because without the sources of our survival, without healthy waterways, without healthy air, without healthy soil to plant in, our survival is not certain by any stretch of the imagination. And when we think about this role of protector, it really is in alignment with our understanding of what a warrior is. We have many words for warriors, and not one of them has any kind of connotation to fighting. They are all about protection. And Yinup is a protector, and that's a word for warrior in our language, and it literally means helper or protector. And when we think about all of the things that we're working on, I think about this ongoing challenges that we have with snowball in Arizona, where our government is complicit in all of these activities because they're fast-tracking these permits. They're allowing people to proceed without the proper environmental studies or without the proper enforcement of the environmental regulations that are already in place. We've seen this with the Dakota Access Pipeline, where they're moving ahead without a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. They're on treaty lands. They haven't met any of the requirements of free, prior, and informed consent. In fact, the United States has been eliminating the consent language from their consultation documents, saying that they only have a need to consult, that they no longer need consent, even though the consent doctrine has been in place for a long time and it's part of all of the international law related to indigenous rights. And so we're seeing the same thing in Snowball, where permits were fast-tracked for a ski resort in Arizona, which is absurd in and of itself, that has never made a profit. And the government fast-tracked their permits, allowing them to use reclaimed wastewater on the mountain for snowmaking, which is filled with biotoxins and endocrine blockers, and is not only a danger to everybody that utilizes that mountain, over 12 tribes gather there for ceremonial purposes, and they also collect medicinal plants in that area. And so using water that comes from a mortuary or a hospital, which is where they're getting their water from, actually eliminates the traditional and cultural purposes that the tribes use the mountain for, because they can't be in a place that has come in contact with illness or death for ceremonial purposes. They can't collect medicinal plants that have been contaminated by water that's come in contact with illness, death, and all of these pharmaceuticals. And they're putting that into the snow that is going on the mountain. So not only is it a constructive eviction of the indigenous peoples, but it's also a hazard to anyone that goes there to participate in these recreational activities on the mountain. Would you want your child skiing someplace where they're likely to get snow in their face and in their mouth and on their skin that has biotoxins in it and endocrine blockers in it? I certainly wouldn't. We're facing the same challenges here in my homeland with the struggle to protect the Penobscot River from industrial development, where the state has made a preemptive strike against indigenous rights here, against our territorial water rights, in order to pave the way for industry to come through here unchecked. And so we're seeing all of these things that are happening where we're always kind of volleying the corporations out in the front. And certainly they are the ones leading the charge. But the ones who are forging the path with the sword out in front of them is our government. And we have to recognize that we have lost control in a large way of what's going on in this country, that our rights have been completely eliminated by this tag team behavior of the government and these corporations. And how do we, as the people who are from here, how do we address these issues in a way that secures our future? And how do we do so nonviolently? And that's really at the heart of what you and I do, Rivera, and what we like to promote on the show is to give people ideas about how do we do that in meaningful ways? How do we address these issues in ways that are effective and that are in alignment with our values as nonviolent activists and practitioners?
I think that's a really important point, Sherry, that we have a rogue state, a rogue government going on, that we really need to grapple with this deeply, each and every single one of us who considers ourselves citizens of the United States, that we have a responsibility to acknowledge that our government, with all of its massive control and capacity, is not actually being held in check by the will of the people. And that's a very dangerous thing. It's very important to be able to acknowledge that. Now, it's questionable whether it ever was held in control by the will of the people. You don't have to look at history to acknowledge what's going on in the present, but it can sometimes inform your choices moving forward. When I think about the pipeline resistance struggles that are also going on in non-Native communities, such as the one with the Burrville Power Plant in Rhode Island, or Cove Point in Maryland, or the West Roxbury pipeline that is right in the middle of a neighborhood of Boston, that the people in those areas are also learning quite rapidly that the government does not stand up for their right or their safety either. They're not standing up for our future, and none of this entire massive system is taking a responsible stance on the development of fossil fuel infrastructure, not just in terms of its toxicity or its environmental pollution effects, but in terms of the larger output effect of climate change. And we know that's a serious problem. When we think about this idea of using nonviolent action to protect ourselves, our communities, our land, the other creatures in the systems that we are a part of, it really makes me reflect on a use of nonviolent struggle that is termed nonviolent civilian-based defense. This is a very particular use of nonviolent struggle that has been theorized and developed to replace the idea that we need a standing army to protect and defend our homelands from the onslaught of an invasion of another army. This has been used in different places around the world where you have a small nation without the military capacity to fend off a much more well-armed army of a bigger nation. Now, what we're looking at here is that the onslaught is corporate, and for the most part, and that the defense we need to be using is nonviolent, and it is to protect people and water and land. But the dynamics are very parallel and very similar, and we can learn a lot from how these have been used in other places around the world to deny cooperation to the invading army or the occupiers, to thwart their attempts to gain control and power over tangible resources in the area, to lose papers, deny permits, to resist them both socially and functionally within the places they need to occupy to continue on their devastating path. These are all tools and tactics that we can learn from, rooted in nonviolence. And we're seeing some of them being used in the frontline struggles that are resisting the coming pipelines that are literally being built and being resisted every inch of the way. One of the things that has been evoked recently in the discussion of climate change is the metaphor of war. And I think it's very important to grapple with that metaphor and the negative implications that arise when we start to talk about this struggle in terms of war. I don't see it as a war. I see that there is an onslaught, there is a destruction that needs to be resisted. There are things that need to be protected. But ultimately, where the real heart of this struggle lies is not in war, but in healing and in waging peace and justice. And that's an entirely different dynamic of how we're going to go about resolving this massive problem that we're facing.
Yeah, and I think that there are so many interesting historical prototypes for civilian-based defense. And what we're talking about when we talk about civilian-based defense, like Rivera said, is really using deterrence against external aggression and any type of internal uprising or usurping to be accomplished by reliance on social, economical, political, and psychological tools. A lot of people refer to these as weapons, but I just, you know, I don't like to use that word. And people need to understand how this works. They need to understand, what do these catchphrases mean in real life? And how do we apply these things in a way that actually is effective? How do we engage in widespread non-cooperation and massive public defiance? And so how do we utilize that to our benefit in order to put a stop to the status quo militarization and militarized alternatives that keep getting forced down our throats? How do we deny those who are attacking us, whether it be our land, our water, our ability to live with any type of economic or racial justice? How do we prevent them from meeting their objectives and make it impossible for them to continue to consolidate their rule over us? And how do we utilize these things in our own community to shift those who are a party to that back toward a place of humanity? Because that's what we're really talking about. We're talking about really humanizing ourselves to one another. And we're talking about standing up for the humanity within us all. But we're also talking about honoring our connectivity as human beings to all life. So there's all of these multi-layered pieces to this puzzle that I think it's easy for people to get confused about. How do we do this? How do we formulate a plan to be able to do some type of effective wide scale or even small scale civilian-based defense to address the national and international problems that we have? How do we turn our formula for defense into a civilian-based defense rather than a national militarized or even international corporate run militarized defense that we've seen historically that's done nothing but continue to make the world less and less safe? And so maybe we could talk a little bit about some of those prototypes. We can give people some ideas about what it might look like to do this work in real time and in a way that was really effective at addressing the challenges that we all face, because there are so many challenges. Everybody has their own focus of work that they're trying to accomplish. And so what do you think, Rivera? Can we take a little bit of time and talk about what some of those prototypes are and help to guide people a little bit more deeply into this work that we talk about all the time but don't have enough opportunity to dive deeply into?
Definitely. And that's why we have these review and reflection shows, to give the space for this conversation to unfold. I think one of the things to first think about is that one thing we can draw from the metaphor that has been explored by not just armies, but any form of complex organization, is the need for planning and preparation. We often act in a reactionary way to the crises that unfold in our communities. And if we want to roll back that timeline, take command of that timeline of resistance or struggle or resilience or change or transformation, there's many words, but if we want to take control of that timeline, we need to be preparing and planning every single day. It's like if you're going to compete in the Olympics, let's say. You don't just show up at the Olympics. You train and you prepare and you learn your skills. Nonviolent struggle for me is the same way. And that's one of my great passions in life, is bringing that understanding into our communities, that we need to train and prepare. And that means we need to go and research, we need to read, we need to understand strategy, we need to understand organizing. We need to be networked together so we can organize. What we're seeing in North Dakota is not just happening out of nowhere. It comes out of decades, you could even say centuries, of resistance and organizing, protecting and defending that has been going on in Indigenous communities. It's also been drawing on the support networks of allies, of people who have been doing this work for a long time. We see this in many of our communities that do successfully come together to create change. And we need to think about that very deeply and how we can foster that in our communities. So that's the first thing, is to really think about that planning. And to use a specific model and example, I want to relate the story of what the province of Quebec did when they found out frackers were going to come into their area and do hydraulic fracking underneath the St. John River. They organized in many different ways, and one of them was to actually prepare a plan of using nonviolent action to resist the frackers coming in. And in drawing up this plan, they went through step by step, where are the points on the road where we can actually block the fracking trucks? How can our city officials and our village officials deny them permits? How can we blockade their access points for water so they can't get the water that they need to frack? How can we disrupt the public permit processes and the hearings? And let's start training people today as if this is inevitable. And then let's publicize the fact that we have a trained group of citizens who are prepared to wage this struggle. And then let's do a cost analysis on how much this is going to cost the industry to fight this battle with us. By doing this and by publicizing this, they were able to hold off the frackers for 11 years in the province of Quebec, and they're now in a new phase of their effort. But it's an important story to understand the use of planning and preparation, training and organizing as a deterrent to that which wants to come into the areas. I think this is the basis of civilian-based defense, and this model used it in a specific example that I think is very pertinent to all of our lives. It can be applied to many different struggles that we're facing. I want to make one more point and before I turn it back to you, Sherry, which is about this discussion of tools versus weapons. There is a language that talks about nonviolent struggle as a form of alternative warfare or irregular warfare that also uses the tools of nonviolent action. It calls them weapons. I, like Sherry, do not use that language, and here's why. Because for me, nonviolent action is a set of tools for a functional democratic society. These are the ways that we give or we withhold our consent and cooperation. And if we are really going to strive to live up to the ideals that were set forth by the very founding principles of this country, which we know are only ideals that we've tried to live up to over the years and mostly failed, but that doesn't mean we give up on those standards. To be a government ruled by the consent of the governed, to be governed by the will of the people, then we need every tool of nonviolent action available to us to be able to use in being a functional democratic society. I firmly believe that, and that's why I do not use the word weapons. Weapons are things that we use when our ways of being human with each other, our ways of conflict negotiation, have fallen short, have fallen flat, or have been abandoned by us in pursuit of our own greed or our own ideologies. Tools are things that we use to construct, to build, to shape, to create together the world that we want to live in. And that's why I think this language shift is very important, because it creates a basis and a framework for how we approach the work that we're doing with our fellow human beings in terms of making change.
I think that's really important because we see a lot of people who are out there who we know are working to protect the environment, who are using war language, and all this does is create enemies. And so when we're using the language of war, then we have to identify an enemy. And when we're using the language of nonviolence, we're learning to cooperate with one another, to collaborate with one another toward a common goal. In this instance, our common goal is protection of the environment, protection of our vital ecosystems, protection of life on this planet, which includes protection of our land, our waterways, our air, and our brothers and sisters who are also being brutally attacked. And so we need to start thinking about the way that we frame these things. And this argument over language has become almost saccharine in some ways, where people are so consumed by terminology that they lose sight of what they're doing. So it's kind of taken the weight out of the importance of the language that we use. One of the things that I was taught, one of the things that I believe, is that our words have power. There's a certain alchemy to the language that we use, the vibrational frequency of it, the intent with which it's delivered, that actually influences what we're able to manifest. The reason that my people carried on an oral tradition was not because we lacked the ability to be able to write. We certainly had written form, and we had agreements between other tribes that were transferred in wampum that had a specific language that was tied to it. However, we understood that the words that we used, that we gave life to, that we put out into the world, were actually part of the creation process. And that when we use our language in a way that defines certain parameters, then what we're creating, what we're building with that language is actually more likely to manifest in the framework of war, if we're using the language of war, if we're using the language of destruction, of violence, of conquest, then those are the things that we're going to be framing and that we're going to be creating more of. So we have to be really careful about how we use language, but also keep it in context, focused on why are we choosing our language so carefully. It's not because we're part of, you know, some sickly sweet, politically correct movement. It's because we're consciously aware that what we're creating is framed by the words that we choose to define it with. And so that piece, I think, is really, really important, because we have been seeing a lot of these words of war, these words of conquest being used by people within the environmental movement. And I mean, it's certainly, there are new campaigns that are out there right now that we're aware of, Rivera. You and I have discussed this, where they're using the language of war to define the work that's being done. And if we're going to be looking to create something that is in harmony with the natural world, something that is in harmony with other living beings on this planet, certainly in harmony with other human beings, then we need to be using language that actually defines and forms the structure for that to be built upon. So I'm sure we could go on about that for several shows. But there are other things that we want to be able to talk about. And one of the things that I think is important is for us to be able to stress to people the importance of having a specific strategy. One of the ways that you can form a specific strategy for addressing an issue is to look at what the objectives are of the other party. Look at what it is they're trying to accomplish that you feel is an endangerment to our planet, to our people. And think of ways that you can non-cooperate actively in order to prohibit them from reaching that objective.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a Station ID.
We know the sweet world is not going to end, because it's always returning to beginning again. And tomorrow,
a in a lot of instances, the bottom line is money. And so when we can prevent movement forward with some of these projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline and other pipelines that have been proposed, certainly other extraction activities like fracking, where we've been able to hold the line, which I've mentioned on the show many times before, the word that we have for that comes from our language, our warrior language base, is Samognus, holding back the tide of harm without harming the other. When we can hold that line long enough for them to reach an economic tipping point so that it's no longer financially viable for them to continue, then we've achieved one of our objectives by preventing them from achieving their objective. And there are a number of ways that you can achieve success within your movements by engaging in that process. But as Rivera said, you have to become very knowledgeable. You not only have to become knowledgeable about the practices of nonviolence, but you also have to become very knowledgeable about the practices of those that you're working to stop. You have to become very knowledgeable about what their goals and objectives are. You have to understand what their bottom line is. You have to understand what their profit margin is. You have to become very savvy in understanding how they operate in order for you to be able to create disruptions that will prevent them from meeting their objectives, so that you can let them know that we are no longer going to accept business as usual. We are no longer going to allow them to profit off the backs of people, off the backs of other living beings within that ecosystem, that we are not going to allow them to profit off from death. And that's what's been happening for a very, very long time. And so in order for us to be able to achieve those things, we have to become very, very knowledgeable about all of these factors. And one of the things that I think is really important to understand is that no one person can manage all of that on their own. And so, you know, one of the things that Rivera and I teach about is leaderful rather than leadership. I'll let her talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But recognizing that there are multiple aspects involved in being able to create an effective strategy or campaign or movement, that there are people that bring very unique gifts. And we often hear criticism amongst different groups who all have the same basic objective. They all have the same basic goals, and yet they criticize one another because people are doing things differently. Well, that's part of the beauty that we're actually working to preserve, is our diversity. You know, one of the things that we're counting on is our ability to be able to bring different skill sets to the table. And I think it's really important, if we want to start unifying the work that we're doing, start really thinking about what our collective goals are, we have to start honoring all of the different lines that come together to lift the movement up, and recognize that each individual line has its own set of specified skill sets that are attached to it, and a specified set of work that's attached to it. And each one of those lines is incredibly important. And we need to learn how to recognize that, how to honor that, and how to strengthen our own line while at the same time working in collaboration with all of the others, so that we are building a strong net to lift the whole movement up. So, Rivera, why don't you talk a little bit about the disbursement of leadership or leaderful movements, and how distributing and dispersing the roles of leaders within the movement can actually strengthen the movement and actually protect it going forward.
That's a great subject to explore, Sherry, and really important one. There's a couple of points to make about it. One, it's not just internal to a movement, it's how we relate to a broader system with a lot of organizations, as you were pointing out, or other movements or other campaigns. Oftentimes we get into a silver bullet mentality to what we already know is a systemic problem. So we start hearing ourselves squawking with one another about, oh, my way is the best way. And we start to fight with each other about whether there should be a legislative campaign or a legal lawsuit campaign or a nonviolent direct action campaign. This weakens us, especially when we start to fight over resources with one another. I have found in my own work that when I can really approach someone whose strategy I don't agree with from a place of, if you can go do that and respect what I need to do, let's see if we can work in at least respectful disagreement about strategy rather than active fighting with one another. I feel like sometimes in our movements, we end up doing the work of our opposition for them by dragging each other down. This is just something to reflect on. It's not an easy path. It's not necessarily easy to do. There are personalities that trip us up, including our own. But if we really want to tap into this phenomenal potential that we have as a complex, multi-stranded movement of movements, as a swarm of human beings with millions of us who can be involved in this, then these are the types of questions we need to be asking ourselves. These are the approaches we need to be pondering. Within our movements, we want to really look for that diversity that you were just mentioning, Sherry, that leader-full structure. And one of the easiest and simplest ways to go about doing this that I have found is to start to deeply honor and respect every role in the movement. So to honor with all of your heart and all of your soul the mother who shows up with cookies for the bake sale to fund the movement. To honor and respect deeply with all of your heart the people who are going into the schools to talk to the children about loving the animals and loving the earth and loving the water. To honor and respect with all of our heart the people who want to pray for the success of a movement, to hold up that spiritual pillar of what needs to be done. And to equally honor, but not excessively honor, the people who take what we already honor and respect in our society, those who step forward to the microphones to speak, those who do the media work, those who end up reporting on these things at large functions and gatherings, those who get arrested, those who do the frontline organizing work. So what we're really looking at here is approaching our movements with a sense of deep honoring and respecting of every role, every contributor that becomes a profoundly powerful equalizing force that is about lifting up everyone together. This is good for us. It's good for our movements. It's also good for our society as a whole. We're coming out of thousands of years of conquest mentality, of intense hierarchies in which the king was honored and respected and the garbage pickers were kept down like trash that they were gathering, where women were subjugated, where people with different skin colors were subjugated, where we've made this intense pecking order. And if we really want to have transformative movements, it has to start in our hearts and in how we organize our movements and respect, honor and uplift everywhere that we can. I think this is a transformative power that we can unleash within our own lives, our own movements, and in the change that we are making. One last point to throw in there is that as we're thinking about our opposition, our enemies, quote unquote, we need to remember Dr. King's great insight that we want to be against injustice and not against the people. That at the end of the day, these are our brothers and sisters. And just as if it was my blood brother or my blood sister, someone I was born with, I have a twin sister. If my twin sister and I are in a fight and I disagree with what she's doing, if I even think that it's so dangerous what she's decided to do, that I have to take direct action to block her from taking that path. It's her action that I'm against, not her. I was born with her in the womb, just as we were all born together on this planet, in the womb that we share of this earth. And at the end of the day, no matter how infuriating their behaviors are, we are still going to be living on this planet together because we're acting through nonviolence. We're not setting out to have a war and to kill these other people. We're not setting out to go and shame them so much that they kill themselves. Our goal is to reach for their humanity and our humanity at the same time. And that is not an easy goal. I can't pretend that it is, because when we have been hurt and abused, when someone has been so disrespectful that it's almost impossible to comprehend, this is the one of the hardest tasks to do as a human being, but I also feel very strongly that I have not found a way to move forward on our struggles without addressing this exact thing in myself. My willingness to dehumanize someone else, to make them the enemy, the monster. If I really want to be effective, I have to see them as a human being, and I have to do that hard work for myself.
You know, this brings me back to the discussion that we had with Simon in this, from the Center for Transformational Practice. When we think about change making and transformation of our communities and our society at large, we can't separate that from transformation within ourselves, which means that we have to be willing to address the ways that we engage those who we disagree with, that this work is not to be done with those who have the same ideas as us, because then we wouldn't have any conflict. You know, we have to be willing and able to be able to engage those that we disagree with in a way that allows for us to find a common point of convergence and to build on that commonality to work toward the sustainability of our planet and of all life, to work toward a clear brokered peace between disparate groups. And I think one of the problems that we need to address is our reliance on some other to resolve our conflict, that we have become so dependent on others solving our problems that it has almost become an entitlement in many places, that we feel that we're entitled to have someone else solve our problems for us. And if we want to be able to really create change in a democratic way, the grassroots movement, then we need to learn how to be able to manage our own conflicts. There are so many times when the police are called and the situation ends in tragedy, where the conflict could easily have been resolved with people within the area knowing how to step out and to step up and to help those in conflict resolve that conflict nonviolently without the intervention of a militarized force or a police force. We have to be teaching these things in our schools, which is the importance of all of the programs that we've had featuring individuals who are doing this work in the schools and in the communities with the young people. We have to teach our young people, we have to teach ourselves how to manage conflict in such a way that we don't leave that process up to someone else, that we're the ones that are facilitating the resolution of our conflicts ourselves. And we're doing so in a way that is in alignment with our own personal values and goals, and that we are also able to be mindful of the goals and the personal values of the other that we face. And learning how to do that and to have those conversations in small and in big ways is what needs to happen here in order for real transformational change to occur. And so when we start thinking about all of these issues, that really is at the heart of what we're doing, how we communicate with one another, what is our capacity to be able to engage the other human to human, eye to eye, breath to breath, heart to heart. How are we able to bring all of ourselves to that process of engaging that other in a loving and humane way? And to me, there isn't anything that's more important than us being able to develop our ability to do that in all of the work that we're doing and in our own personal relationships. I mean, it starts with the individual and it spirals out. And so if we're going to really be able to do this work going forward in a way that's going to be meaningful, effective, and long-lasting, then we need to have that skill be kind of central to all of the other things that we're going to be doing out there in the world to address the many challenges that we face. Because the separation that has been created, we're separated from our food sources, so we're separated from the earth. We're separated from one another with our ability to shoot weapons from great distances. We don't have to face the person that we're harming. We're separated from one another in so many different ways. And it's that sense of separation that enables us to be able to operate in ways that are blind to our interrelatedness and our interconnectedness. And we need to regain our vision in regard to those things. And the only way to do that is to close the gap in that separation. We can't close the gap in that separation if we're continuously blaming and pointing fingers at the other and not looking at ways that we can reconnect to, realign with, and harmonize our lives with those others and with the rest of creation, because that's what it's going to take on a large scale in order for us to be able to create the kind of change that's going to ensure our survival going forward.
That separation is completely key to understanding this entire question of the climate crisis that we are in. And that is why we made the point early on in the show that the language of war, such as the war on climate or the war against those who are waging war on climate, is so dangerous. It is that separation and that warring mentality, that conquest mentality, the separation from the earth that saw it as a resource for humans to extract, that has brought us to this very crisis. And as Jeanette Rankin said, she was the first U.S. congresswoman, "You can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake. A war is a devastating, destructive force. It does not actually resolve our problems together." And when we're looking at the climate crisis and the complex conflicts that underlie this crisis that we're in, more war is not going to solve this problem. We don't need to actually make war on the industries that are causing the climate crisis. We don't actually need to think of the earth as making war on us as humans. We don't need to go into Halliburton mentalities of building seawalls and profiting off the destructions of wars. We don't need to go into disaster capitalism. What we really need to do and really grapple with is the fact that human beings as a collective whole that have gone down a path of separation need to reach down and touch the earth. They need to reach out and touch each other. They need to understand that we have viable skills for waging peace, for healing, for connecting, for looking at the pain and the hurt that is underlying our hearts and our souls and our communities, and repairing and restoring the relationships that have been severed for thousands of years. This is a very profound realization, to understand that the art of waging peace, the art of healing, is strong enough, is powerful enough to bring us back home to our own very own survival. I truly believe in this. I know that we can do it. I watch people do it around the world in nonviolent struggle after nonviolent struggle after nonviolent struggle, in communities and towns, in the schools, in the classrooms, in our homes and communities, in the very way that we bring forth life into this world. We are using these skills that really have been with us since the dawn of humanity's existence. The skills of cooperation, collaboration, discourse, discussion, coming together, looking at a conflict, thinking about how to resolve this conflict. We didn't get here to our present existence as a species through war and violence and domination. We've survived all that. But what's really gotten us to this point, as the biologists know and the evolutionists know, is our ability to work together, is our ability to look at our conflicts and find ways to collaborate and cooperate so that we can move forward from the problem that we're facing to the time that's coming. And I think these are the things that we need to reflect on as we're going to address and meet the climate crisis that we're in, as we're going to protect our communities and our land and our water from our brothers and sisters and the corporations that they control that are moving forward in pursuit of their own interests, heedless of the destruction that they're causing. I think we can do this. I know we can do this. I'm seeing us do this all over the world. And I know that each and every one of us who's listening to this show today can be a part of this change, a part of this kind of belief moving forward. I know that Sherry and I are.
We definitely are, and we're in it for life. And that's one of the things that I think that we need to recognize, is that this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. We have a number of critical issues that need to be addressed on the planet, not just in this country, but on the planet, and that none of those issues are going to be able to be resolved if we do not have the ability to sustain life. And the only way that we're going to have the ability to sustain life is to preserve our waterways. And so this is right now, I think, the most unifying and galvanizing issue that we have is the protection of our waterways, because we can't do any of the other work that we need to do if we can't stay alive. And so when we think about the examples of things that have been done in other parts of the world to come together and protect the water, I think that the story of the defenders of the water in Bolivia is one of the most inspiring stories. And I would encourage all of you to do some research on that, become familiar with that, what this little country did against these superpowers who came in and tried to take control of their water. Right now, what we're seeing is a very clear, a very hostile, a very militarized attempt to not only take control of our water, but in many instances to destroy our water. Water is one of the things on this planet that we cannot make more of. You know, we've never learned how to do that despite all of our scientific expansion and growth. We've never learned how to collide atoms to create water. And so we have a limited amount of water on this planet, and we need to be able to preserve that in order to preserve our lives so that we can move forward to do all of the other work that we have to do. We have a number of things that are very, very important. We have economic injustice. We have racial injustice. There are so many different areas where people are being treated really horrifically as a result of being who they are, whether they are poor, people of color, or transgendered people, people that are part of the gay and lesbian community. I mean, there are so many areas where we need to balance our humanity, but we can't do any of that work if humanity is snuffed out by a lack of water. And so right now, thinking about all of the people who are standing in North Dakota, standing for the water, for Nibe, who are there protecting the right to life of all living beings within that region, I acknowledge and honor the stand that you're making, and we all stand with you. And we began our show thinking about the folks that were there. We have from here, from Benoibskeag territory and other Wabanaki tribes, there are people that are there, people that are on their way there. There are people that are on their way back from being there. We all stand together with you. And the allies that are standing with the indigenous people, at this point, there are more than 100 tribes represented at the camp. And there are also a number of allies, non-native allies, who are standing there with them, because people the world over recognize that we need to protect our water, that it's crucial, because this element of our existence is found not only in the earth, but it's also within our bodies, that we are connected to it, we are related to it in very real ways. And we understand that our life is dependent upon the health and the preservation of those waterways. So I'm hoping that we can all start to recognize that all of these things that we're working on are interrelated, and that there is no one issue necessarily that's higher than another within this hierarchy, because there are things that are distinctly important to each individual group. However, every single one of those issues will fail to be addressed if we fail to exist, because we haven't done the work that is required of us to protect and preserve our waterways.
We know that all over the country right now, people are responding to a nationwide call of solidarity with the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is going on September 3rd through 17th, and that people are saying no more. But I think beyond just even this pipeline, there's a growing recognition among people that to be human today in our world regardless of who you are, regardless of where you are, is to reimagine our stance in life, that we are not just consumers, we're not just even citizens, but we are engaged change makers, transforming a culture that has been built on so much injustice we can hardly name it all. Certainly not in one breath, certainly not in one show. But that we are being called, each and every single one of us, to redefine what being human means in these times. That we will know about nonviolent struggle. That we will be connected to the movements and campaigns for change. That we will learn about how to be resilient, how to reconnect to our communities. That we will be informed, awake, engaged. And that we will know how to put our hands into the struggles in ways that help, not harm further. I think this is something that is really at the heart of how I define being human and being a human being in these times.
This reminds me of the story that I've told on the show, and I often tell when I'm speaking, about the message from the ancestors that came through to one of my Anishinaabe sisters and a group that she was working with, where the ancestors told them, "We dreamed you into the future." And so when we talk about imagining a new way of being, about imagining and reimagining our way forward, we have to also remember the responsibility that we carry to dream new generations into being in the future. And so as we do this work, we have to really be mindful of our lineage that is connected deeply to this impetus of life that goes back to the beginning, and to recognize the responsibility that we have to continue to perpetuate life forward. And the only way that we're going to do that is to start living in harmony and in alignment with life. And I hope that what we do here on this show gives people an opportunity to consider their role in that lineage of life and to think about how they can adjust and transform their ways of being with one another in the world in order to preserve that right to life that we've been granted to the generations that are yet to come.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to my very wise and insightful and beautiful co-host, Sherry Mitchell. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have this conversation with her today. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd also like to thank my intelligent, insightful, and awake and aware co-host, Rivera-san. If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program that can come to your local radio station. All you have to do is call them and ask them to put it on the air. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera's Son's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Sherry told us the story of her Anishinaabe sister, who talked about how the ancestors dreamed them into the present. It's important to reflect that through all our long millenniums of violence, war, domination, conquest, there have always been hearts like ours who dreamed through the nightmare of their times, people like us who would come into the present to stop the violence, to stop the dangers, to stop the destruction, and to heal, to transform, but most importantly, to work together and to love. So, listeners, perhaps you'll find another way to step actively into the lineage of life and creation and be the dream that the ancestors dreamed by the time we talk to you next week.